that mind, Zeron reiterates that all sanctions against it must be lifted in a verifiable manner in the run-up to the upcoming Vienna talks. Anger boils in Jordan over the normalization of ties with Israel, with thousands protesting a water for energy deal their country has newly signed with Israel. And also, Palestinians hold a funeral for a 14-year-old boy who was shot dead by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran says the upcoming Vienna talks with the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal, or the JCPOA, can yield a good and even immediate agreement. The Iranian foreign minister made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Hossein Ami Abdullahi, however, stressed that any agreement requires a readiness on the other side to fully return to its commitments and remove sanctions on Iran in a verifiable manner. He said, despite the violation of the JCPOA by the U.S. and the European signatories, Iran attends the talks in good faith and with seriousness. He called for sufficient and strict guarantees that the U.S. would not abandon the agreement again. For his part, Josep Borrell said, the only way for the removal of sanctions on Iran is the revival of the nuclear deal. Well, the fate of the Iran nuclear deal under the spotlight as the Austrian capital, Vienna, prepares to host a new round of talks among the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. In the following report, we will tell you how the hard-earned achievement of international diplomacy has unraveled over the past years.
On life support, in tatters, and on the verge of collapse. These are some of the terms that have been used to describe the current status of the hard-earned nuclear deal that emerged in 2015 after so many rounds of painstaking diplomacy between Iran and the P5+1 group of countries. The deal is almost dead, with the U.S. having abandoned it, the European parties failing to abide by their commitments or make up for the damage from the U.S. withdrawal, and Iran having rolled back some of its commitments. Who's to blame for the status quo? Many point the finger at former American President Donald Trump and his favorite maximum pressure policy involving a long list of anti-Iran sanctions. His successor, Joe Biden, a vociferous critic of Trump's confrontational approach, has insisted that he wants to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But after taking office in January, his administration has enforced every single sanction that the former president imposed against the Iranians. This has led Iran to doubt Biden's seriousness. Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, between April and June to find a path back into compliance with the deal. But critics say the Biden administration missed that window of opportunity by refusing to make up for America's unilateral withdrawal and provide proper assurances that it will not violate the deal again. Despite this, the involved parties are going to give diplomacy another chance with a new round of talks scheduled to take place later this month.
Iran and the P4+1 are preparing for a new round of talks, with Tehran insisting that the negotiations must lead to the removal of sanctions. Observers are wondering how the United States and its European allies are going to build confidence after many years of violations of their promises. This next report, and try to find out.
Discussions are set to resume in Vienna next week. Top negotiators from Iran, Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany will sit down for talks again. U.S. representatives will also be in the city, but not in the same room, as Iranians won't directly talk to the party that unilaterally withdrew from the international deal. What are the talks' chances of success? Iran says to be successful, the dialogue must lead to the removal of sanctions. Tehran also insists that America must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the deal again. The U.S. has repeatedly rejected Iranian demands for such guarantees. How is the U.S. planning to deal with its seriously damaged credibility? The head of Iran's permanent mission to the international organizations in Vienna said this week that the United States should prove its goodwill by removing sanctions against Tehran. During a meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors, he said that the credible and effective lifting of sanctions is the basis of Iran's willingness to abide by the terms of the agreement. He said it is unfortunate that European countries still do not want to openly condemn the unilateral withdrawal of the United States and the reimposition of sanctions, which is the only cause of all current problems.
First of all, in order to understand Europe, you have to understand the European Union. To understand the European Union, you have to understand it is under the control of Germany. Germany is a vassal state of the United States of America. Germany was conquered after World War II, where they lost the war, and they have been a vassal state ever since that time. The vassal does not tell the sovereign what to do. That's why they're not arguing with the United States. The United States tells them what to do, not the other way around.
It is definitely hard to guess what direction the talks will take, but the next meeting could shed light on how the two sides will approach the discussions.
Moving on, anger in Jordan over the normalization of ties with Israel. Thousands have hit the streets in Amman to protest a recent cooperation deal between Jordan and Israel on energy and water. Protesters condemn the deal as humiliating. They say normalization of ties with Tel Aviv is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. Under the U.S. brokered deal, Jordan will provide solar power to Israel in exchange for desalinated water. The United Arab Emirates, which hosted the signing ceremony on Monday, will reportedly build the solar power plant in Jordan. The UAE was among several Arab countries that signed a normalization deal with Israel in September 2020, despite widespread opposition from the Muslim world. And elsewhere, hundreds of Palestinians attend the funeral of a teenager shot dead by Israeli soldiers last month in the occupied West Bank. Mourners in Bethlehem chanted anti-Israeli slogans as they said farewell to the victim. They called for justice for 14-year-old Amjad Abu Sultan, who was killed in the city in mid-October. His body was seized by Israeli forces and was not released to his family until late Saturday. Autopsy results show Amjad was shot 3 times at close range. Leaders of different political parties in Pakistan have held a conference in the southern port city of Karachi to condemn the UK's declaration of the Palestinian movement of Hamas as a terrorist organization, Mohammed Turi reports.
The All Parties Conference is convened here in the commercial hub of Pakistan to condemn the UK's move of declaring Hamas a terrorist organization.
Participants of the conference stressed on the need for unity among Muslims and called on the international community to take serious notice of what they call the unilateral action of the old colonial power, the UK, who gave birth to the Zionist regime in the heart of Muslim world.
The conference was organized by Palestine Foundation of Pakistan, aiming to launch further series of week-long activities across the country.
We are all very much disturbed because of the United Nations and the United States policies about the Palestine and about the Israel. Israel is killing Muslims in all over the Palestine, and they are burning the houses and the colonies of the Muslim and building up the colonies for the Jews.
It's a clear nonsense because, you know, the Hamas is the only representative of the Palestinian. All the organizations, they are represented by the peoples. They do not involve in terrorism. The UK and Australian have their own terrorist organization, which was supported by UK. Our terrorists from Karachi is in UK, and they were giving the shelter to them. So this is a nonsense, and we do not accept that. and we condemned it.
The UK's move in November coincided with Balfour Declaration in 1917, when British colonial imperialist power created the Zionist apartheid.
Actually, Israel is defeating. Israel will be no more in the map of world in nearby future. So that's why their creator, especially British government and United States administration, they are worried.
Participants called on the Prime Minister Imran Khan to do more than mere condemnation of the UK's government, that instead of apologizing and correcting its historical wrongs across the world and against the Palestinian people, is supporting the aggressor both in Kashmir and Palestine. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
We're going to go back to one of our previous stories now, where anger in Jordan over the normalization of ties with Israel is boiling over. Thousands have hit the streets in Amman to protest a recent cooperation deal between Jordan and Israel on energy and water. Writer and political analyst Said Shabi joins us now from the British capital, London. Let's hit the ground running with you, Mr. Shahabi, and give us your thoughts on this recent deal.
Thank you very much. This is a very disturbing news, although we are used to having news from Jordan that they were contacting Israel and establishing links with them. Unfortunately, this time it is the United Arab Emirates that is pushing Jordan to reach this agreement with Israel, by which Jordan is going to create energy, what they call green energy, to give it to Israel. And in return, they will get some water from desalination plants from the occupiers. Now, the UAE, the Emirates, is paying for the whole process. It's paying for to build the energy supply, the generation of electricity generation in Jordan using these new technologies, solar panels and so on. It just to ensure that Jordan goes into more practical relations with Israel. Like now, Morocco also is going to import more arsenal and more weapons and from Israel. It is the UAE that is pushing all these countries to establish links, practical links, and to enter into more agreements with the with the Israelis. I just don't understand why the UAE has placed itself as the foreign ministry of Israel, which it goes to African countries, to Arab countries, in order to encourage them to normalize relations with the occupiers of Palestine. This is one of the worst scenarios and worst situations that I have ever come across in the past 50, 70 years after the creation of Israel. So this is a very, very tragic situation in which Jordan is binding itself with long-term agreements with the occupiers, while the Palestinians are killed almost every day. There is rarely a day that passes without a Palestinian being killed by the Israelis. This is a very disturbing situation, and this is why the people of Jordan today went to the streets in protest against this. The Jordanians, most Arab people and Muslim people, do not want to go that far without Israel withdrawing from the Palestinian land.
Mr. Shahabi, one of the messages of the protesters who condemned this deal was that normalization of ties with Tel Aviv is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. Is that what has happened here with these normalization deals of other Persian Gulf Arab countries? Have they effectively turned a blind eye to the suffering of their brethren?
Well, the Israeli ambassador in Bahrain today, he talked, there was an interview with him in one American website, and he said clearly, look, Iran went to Syria and Lebanon in order to challenge us. Now we are here in their backyard in the Gulf, in Bahrain, in the UAE, to tell the Iranians that we are here, we are in your backyard. So, and then he said that the Bahraini government will not hesitate to cooperate with us to challenge Iran. They told us, I met the foreign minister yesterday, and he told me that, this is what he said, this is the Israeli ambassador in Bahrain, said that he met one of the Khalifi ministers, and he told them that they will not hesitate to seek Israeli help to counter Iran, to challenge Iran. Why? What for? When has the occupiers of Palestine become friends and brothers of the Arabs? And when? Why? And what for? What do we gain out of it? What do we, as the people of the region, what do we gain out of that? Because we are bringing Israel into the Gulf, into a very volatile place. What for? What do we gain out of it? Our security, the security of the region, must be secured by the people of the region, not by foreigners. Foreigners will never secure the security of any country. It is their people, it is the inhabitants, the local population, and the local countries who should come together and in, and support and secure the security of the region rather than getting help from outside. Outsiders can never secure the peace of any place.
Writer and political analyst Saeed Chaabi joining us from the British capital, London. Thank you for your comments, sir. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The onus is now on the international community to force Tel Aviv into dismantling its apartheid regime. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Ramzi Barod and Romana Rubello, journalist. This article is titled Raids, Arrests, and Death Threats: Israeli regime's strategy of silencing human rights defenders. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. On October 21st, Israeli regime war minister Benny Gantz announced the issuance of a military order designating six prominent Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations. Gantz claimed that they are secretly linked to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, a socialist political group that the Israeli regime considers a terrorist organization. The Palestinian organization included in the Israeli regime order are Avamir, Prisoner Support and Human Rights, Al-Haq, the Bison Center for Research and Development, Defense for Children Palestine, Union of Agricultural Work Committees, UAWC, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. Considering the significance of these organizations in Palestine and their global networks among like-minded civil society organizations, the Israeli regime decision provoked a public outcry. One of the many statements of the condemnation was a joint statement by rights groups, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, HRW, in which they call Gantz's move an appalling and unjust decision, which represents an attack by the Israeli regime on the international human rights movement. Amnesty International and HRW, which have documented Israeli human rights violations of Palestinians for many years, fully understand that the terrorist designation is consistent with a long trajectory of such unlawful moves. For decades, Israeli regime authorities have systematically sought to muzzle human rights monitoring and punish those who criticize its repressive rule over Palestinians. While staff members of organizations have faced deportation and travel bans, Palestinian human rights defenders have always borne the brunt of the repression. This decision is an alarming escalation that threatens to shut down the work of Palestine's most prominent civil society organizations. Equally important in the world's leading rights group's statement is that it did not fail to highlight that the decades-long failure of the international community to challenge grave Israeli human rights abuses and impose meaningful consequences for them has emboldened Israeli regime authorities to act in this brazen manner. True to form, the international community did react to Gantz's decision, albeit it was the kind of ineffectual reaction which persisted in the realm of rhetoric that is rarely followed by substantive action. A joint statement by UN experts called the Israeli regime decision a frontal attack on the Palestinian human rights movement and on human rights everywhere. Michelle Bachelet, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, criticized the arbitrary decision by the Zionist regime and warned of the far-reaching consequences as a result in terms of work, funding, and support for the targeted organizations. Many governments around the world also condemned the Israeli regime move and echoed the sentiment conveyed by UN experts. Even the United States expressed its concern, though, using the same typically cautious and non-committal language. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price told reporters on October 23rd in Washington that his country believes respect for human rights, fundamental freedoms, and a strong civil society are critically important to responsible and responsive governance. Instead of an outright condemnation, however, Price said that The United States will be engaging Israeli partners for more information regarding the basis for these designations, unquote. However, like other governments, and certainly unlike Amnesty International and HRW, Price made no link between the Israeli regime decision of October 21st and numerous other past practices targeting human rights and civil society groups in Palestine, and more recently, in the occupied territories as well. Also worth noting is that the supposed link between such organizations and the socialist PFLP is not new. At Damir in December 2012, the Israeli regime army raided the headquarters of Damir in Ramallah, confiscating laptops and a video camera. The offices of the Union of Palestinian Women Committees were also raided by the Zionist regime occupation forces on the same day. The organization is one of the six now designated by the Zionist regime as terrorists. In September 2019, Damir's offices were raided once again. The Israeli regime military raid at the time, however, did not generate as much attention or outrage, despite the accompanying violence, let alone the blatant violation of human rights. Then, Al-Haq, also one of the other six effectively banned Palestinian groups, issued a statement warning that the private property of human rights organizations in occupied territories is specially protected under Article 46 of the Hague Regulations. Expectedly, such legal constraints mattered little to the Zionist regime. Al-Haq's staff have faced many restrictions throughout the years. Shawan Jabari, the general director of Al-Haq, has been banned from travel on various occasions starting in 2006. In March 2009, Jabari was prevented by the Zionist regime from traveling to the Netherlands to receive an award on behalf of his organization. Again, in November 2011, this time, Jabari was now allowed to travel to Denmark. The Zionist regime obstacles began taking even more sinister turns when, in March 2016, Jabari began receiving death threats over the phone. These anonymous calls began arriving in the context of increasing harassment of Al-Haq and its members. Amid their recent work at the International Criminal Court, ICC, seeking justice for human rights violations being committed in the occupied Palestinian territories, the Frontline Defenders website reported. Defense for Children International Palestine in July and again August 2021, Israeli regime forces raided Defense for Children International Palestine DCIP offices in Al-Bira in the occupied West Bank. They seized computers, hard drives, and other material, alleging a link between the organization and the PFLP. This allegation had already been advanced in 2018 when UK lawyers for the Israeli regime, UKLFI, persuaded Citibank and the Arab Bank, PLC, to stop providing banking services to DCIP, providing what they defined as evidence of the close ties to PFLP. While it is true that the recent Israeli regime measures against Palestinian NGOs are a continuation of an old policy, there are fundamental differences between the growing perception of the fake regime of Israel now as an apartheid regime and the misconstrued perception of the past. Even international entities and groups that are yet to brand the Israeli regime as an apartheid regime are becoming familiar with the Israeli regime's undemocratic nature.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Back to Reality. We are glad to have you all on the show. Over here, we discuss about different but interesting topics which we can relate to our daily life. And I'm your host, Hassanain, and today we have got two special guests with us. Salaamu alaykum, brother Sayyid Muhsin.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Welcome to the show. And can you please tell our audience where you're from and what's your field of study?
I'm from Pakistan. I'm currently pursuing my PhD in Islamic Economics from the Hawza Ilmiyaqom.
MashaAllah. And we also have brother Sayyid Abdullah with us. Salaamu alaykum, brother.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And thank you for having me. I am from Iraq, currently residing in Australia. My field of study is Quran and Hadith.
Dear listeners, so without any further delay, let's start with our main discussion. And the topic for today is our different thoughts on afterlife. Somewhere or the other, are you guys trying to say that the whole idea of afterlife is just to serve the justice?
No, it's not just to serve justice. Not only to serve justice, but also to reward people. The idea is there is someone that put these systems in your head that told you right from wrong. And whoever programmed you in this manner, obviously he has a reason for you. He has a point and a plan to get to. For him to be such complex creator, such a genius creator, to give you such magnificent ideas, even when you're young.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is universal. You go to the Amazons where people are running around without clothes, they will tell you killing is wrong. Well, no one told them that killing is haram.
The point is, when human beings on their own make these laws and everything, it's in order to bring justice in the community, in the world, okay, to live peacefully, yeah? So no one is oppressed. But still, we can see, even with these rules that we have made by our own selves, there is an oppression. The people cannot reach to the justice. So there should be a point where there is a justice, where there is people are accountable for what they do. And that is in hereafter, according to, obviously, the beliefs that we have. Therefore, you ultimately are looking for the same thing, but you're trying to look that in this world.
Mm.
Yeah. Whereas this world is the world of trial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is known as dunya. Dunya means something which is very low. It's not everlasting. It is passing enjoyment. Hayatul dunya is a passing enjoyment.
Why do you think that someone should live, in hoping about the future?
So the point is someone who's thinking about the future, what about his own rights, where he should be facilitated with the same thing?
Yeah.
So when he is not being facilitated with the things, then there should be some place where he should get the reward of his sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all are sacrificing for our next generation. What about us? It's not fair. It's not according to the justice. So if I'm sacrificing, if I'm leaving my enjoyment, if I'm... basically,
so what type of
facing
are you talking about?
If I'm facing the hardship, for example, you know, if I'm doing good with everyone, I'm not enjoying my life. You know, I can enjoy my life, but I have to be within the parameters of the rules and regulations which are set for me.
Yeah,
I'm a free man.
You're talking about the laws, right?
Yeah, general
every
life.
Every country.
I'm
sets.
Talking about the general life. Why should I cannot have the money which the others have?
Mm-hmm.
The others are stealing my money. Why can I not steal the money? Yeah, because they're ruled. They do through the processes. Some of them, obviously, the government, they catch them. Some of them not. The ones who are the investors, they do investment. They make things in order to just fill their own pockets.
Uh-huh.
And they do a lot of oppression to those who are obviously poor or the middleman.
Okay.
Yeah, general layman. So who's going to basically make them answerable to what they used to do? If this is the case, then obviously these laws are in vain.
No,
and there is no respect for such laws, and I have the equal right to go and steal the money the way he's stealing my money.
Let's stop here. Inshallah, we continue after a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Dear listeners, welcome back to Back to Reality. And the topic for today is our different thoughts on afterlife.
The law that we have is man-made. As long as this law is made by man, it's subject to change. Give you an example. Death penalty was compulsory. Take a life for a life, a teeth for a teeth, an eye for an eye. Now what happens? You kill someone. They call it second-degree murder. They give you, I don't know, 35 years, 25 years, mm-hmm. And 10 on parole, 5 on good behavior, and you're out. How is that justice? That's not a law. That's a man-made law. So we can't go by these laws that man made, that just to suit his own desires, that they will change whenever the desires clashes with it. Mm-hmm. They have the name of justice, and that's all they have. Okay? Because once you put a judge in the seat and he judges between people, so what you see is fair. I don't see it as fair. Now look at any system in the world, uh-huh. and look at their system when it comes to justice. It's inhumane.
The idea I'm trying to make here
is forget about what you know, right? You have to go back to the basics. Now, you as a human being, I want to get to this point. You as a human being, you want to live a full life, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You want to live happy, joyous with everything. Yeah. Do you ever get the chance to do that? Or do you have to work your... No, you have to work your back off just so you could make some money so you could go to vacation to Hawaii for a week and then you go back to zero.
Everyone has to do that.
You know, if you have kids age 3, 4, and 5 at home, they're the human beings. I'm not saying like let's put them at the level of God, but let's put them at the level of a manager who's managing that house, basically. And he has it under some organized way, obviously, to live. Now, there are two ways. Either he leaves the kids on their own, whatever they want to do, the way they want to live, or he has some specific rules for them, laws for them. And then he says, like, if you will be the good kids or boys, then there is a reward for you.
Okay.
But that is not for now. For later, when you have finished your trial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens is, think of two situations. If he leaves them on their own, what's going to happen? They're going to throw the food that they have everywhere. You know, they're going to make a mess, coloring all the walls and breaking the furniture and everything. So this is what we humans are doing right now. Yeah. Although we have some rules, we have made some rules. For example, kids amongst them, they might make some rule that, look, if you do this, 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 it will be beneficial for us. For example, we will not harm each other. But on the other hand, you can make any mess what you want, but do not fight. It's because when we fight, obviously, there will be a problem amongst us. So we cannot enjoy the life that we have or the time that is free from the parents. So even in the house, we have some rules. Similarly, this world is a world of trial.
So we have to keep waiting and hoping.
We have to keep waiting, hoping, and struggling for the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it depends on the results that we want to gain. The results there is a heaven.
Yeah.
The heaven is based on your good deeds.
Mm-hmm.
So if you follow the good deeds and you go away or you do not go towards the bad deeds, then there is the best future for you.
Okay,
in
so
hereafter.
Yeah. Can you think a person can be a good individual without thinking about afterlife?
Look, the idea, if when you talk about afterlife, first of all, you need to live by what, if Islamically at least, or religiously, you need to live by what you've been told to live. Forget about the afterlife, right? So my first duty is to worry about this life, not the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
The afterlife comes as a consequence of what you do here.
Yeah.
So when the Imam says, "Ad-dunya tusuq," right? It's a market. Rabiha fiha qawmun wa khasra fiha akharun. Some won, some lost. The idea is you need to cost right here. So if I go to a supermarket and I've been given $100 to spend,
mm-hmm.
I could take my $100, go to the aisles and just look at through the items. And then my hour is finished, they say to me, okay, you're out, and I haven't used it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So also money, he says, like he chooses the correct items and the things that he needs and he buys them, he goes to the checkout and he goes out. So there's a difference between the two. The idea is forget about the afterlife. Forget about the checkout. Now concentrate on what is good for you.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
The topic for today is our different thoughts on afterlife.
That's the idea. I need to live here, based on what I've been told, not to live based on what happens. Because, you know, a man came to Imam Ali alayhi salam, says to him, "Ya Amir al-Mu'min, my brother, he left his family and everything. He went to the mountains to worship Allah because he thought, what? I want to go to heaven.
Yeah.
I only get to heaven through ibadah." Through Imam said, "Bring him to me." He says, "Ya adiyya nafsik. You know, why would be on you? You're the enemy of yourself. Who told you that this is the way?" Mm-hmm. "No, you need to live." He said, "Go, feed your family, take care of your family. Yeah. This is what Allah wants from you. So you need to live. Forget about the afterlife. But the afterlife is always a consequence of your action right now. Now, if I have a drink here, right? Mm-hmm. If it's coffee,
yeah,
it's halal. If it's alcohol, it's haram. I'm drinking alcohol, but what am I doing? I'm already like lighting my hell for me. Like I'm preparing fire for myself. So I forget about that for now. So your actions here are what matters. So think of what you do. You do good, you live a happy life without harming anyone, inshallah you enjoy this life and you will enjoy the hereafter." You know, like a person came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, debating him with the same issue. He said to him, "I don't believe in the afterlife." The Imam tried as much as he can.
Uh-huh.
And this person would not fudge. He would not understand. And the Imam said to him, "You know what? If there is no afterlife, we did what we have to do.
Uh-huh.
And then me and you, we lose nothing. He said to him, "Me and you, we don't lose. Mm-hmm. You done nothing. I lived my life and also achieved something. So we're equal. But what happens if it turns out there's an afterlife? I win, you lose."
You know.
So leaving that chance, if it's even a 50-50 chance, I can't risk it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I can't risk it. So the Imam says, if it turns out there's an afterlife, you've lost and I won. And if there's no afterlife, then we both won. You know? Mm-hmm. But I'm keeping myself covered. You're not.
We believe that human has a soul and a body.
Mm-hmm.
And those who do not think or do not believe in hereafter or the life after the death, they think that the body that we have is the only thing that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point is that this body that we have is a tool.
Yeah.
Or means for the soul to live in this material world, because this body is a material body. And when he passes away, when he's basically transferred from this world to another world,
yeah,
another body will be given to that soul. But the actual thing is the soul. And the reason or proof of that we have a soul, because you know this body, when we eat, it goes bigger.
Uh-huh.
When you do not eat. But what about the knowledge that you learn? Yeah, the knowledge that you learn, the things that you memorize, obviously, it should weight you. Like, your weight should increase because of that. There are many other examples as well that can be given, that there is something else where these things are going into there. And they're not affecting on the weight, because the characteristics of the material thing, is that they have a space, they take a space, they, you know, increase, they get older and older by the passage of time. So
yeah,
all these things are there. So we are missing this part, that those who believe in hereafter,
mm-hmm,
or the life after the death, basically they're referring to their souls.
Mm-hmm.
And those who do not believe, they just think like there is no soul, human is the way he is, and after the death there is non-existence, like existence non-existing, where there is nothing such as non-existing after the death.
Mm-hmm.
Death means, or maut, or the intiqal, we use the word intiqal, means to transfer. And it is actually the soul that is being transferred from this world to another world.
Thank you so much, brothers, and thank you so much, dear audience. That's all the time we have for today. And today we're discussing about our different thoughts on afterlife. Until the next program, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
For years, German Muslim women have been fighting against systematic attempts by government to dictate what they can and cannot wear in public and in the workplace. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Hebe Jamal, journalist. This article is published under the heading Islamophobia in Germany. I am not even seen as a person. Stay tuned for more. During the recent German election, polling station assistants in the western town of Bergen initially refused to allow a 21-year-old Muslim woman wearing hijab and a protective mask to cast her ballot. According to reports, the poll workers cited a ban on face coverings for not allowing her to vote, saying voters must be identifiable. The woman was eventually allowed to vote after complaining to city officials, as this was a clear violation of her rights and a blatant display of Islamophobia. In light of this incident, many are now wondering whether other Muslim women were turned away at polling sites, and more broadly, how pervasive is gendered Islamophobia within German society. For years, German Muslim women have been fighting against systematic attempts by government to dictate what they can and cannot wear in public and in the workplace. This past July, the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can ban employees from wearing religious clothing or symbols, including headscarves, under the premise of presenting neutrality. The case was launched by two German Muslim women suspended by their employers for wearing the headscarf. The hyper-politicization of Muslim female identity, where political personalities and the media debate their right to careers and social inclusion, overflows into direct anti-Muslim racism within their everyday lives. Muslim girls at school experience discrimination frequently. Rabia, a 16-year-old German Muslim girl, told Middle East Eye, "I experience anti-Muslim racism so often that sometimes I don't even realize it. I have a school teacher that reduces me to my headscarf, insisting that my parents force me to wear it, even though I explained to him several times that this is not the case. In school, I am not even seen as a person. They don't bother to learn my name. Teachers address me with Fatima only because there is another Muslim girl in my class with that name. My name is Rabia. My name should be remembered. Another young Muslim woman, 19-year-old Nazanin, told Middle East Eye in ninth grade on a school trip, a German woman threw a bottle at me and started yelling racial slurs. I was only 14. My teachers did nothing to stop her. Although I graduated now, the racism has only gotten worse. Within Germany's public school systems, data has shown an alarming amount of discrimination against young Muslim students, specifically girls, leading to a climate of low expectations and discouragement. A survey found that German teachers were more likely to recommend non-ethnic German children to lower school forms than ethnic German pupils, shaping their career and higher educational paths. Ahlam, 19, told Middle East Eye, "My grades suffered because my educator made me believe my upbringing made me a slow thinker. By nature, I stutter. So, he made me feel ashamed for participating in class. My grades only got worse." The anti-Muslim discrimination that women feel in public institutions is reflective of Germany's general attitude towards the hijab. As a visible marker of Muslim identity, it is seen as antithetical to German culture and society. The decision to wear the hijab and to become visibly Muslim changes the status of Muslim women, making them automatically othered. A number of Muslim women, ranging from children to adults, told Middle East Eye that they constantly encounter Islamophobia due to their decision to look visibly Muslim. Sima, 17-year-old, said, "I was walking home one day when a man held his umbrella like a gun to my face. He imitated a gun going off, then called me a terrorist while he and his friend laughed. I couldn't defend myself. I just kept walking." Bushra, 21, was out shopping when another female customer accused her of shoplifting. "I was forced to take off my hijab to prove I wasn't hiding anything under there," she told Middle East Eye, adding, "I was asked what my nationality is, even though I held my German ID card in my hand. When the police let me leave, I only wanted to ask the lady who accused me why." Latifa, 25, recalled, "I applied in a supermarket as they were urgently looking for temporary workers at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. I was told I could not work there with the hijab because the supermarket was neutral." On the first day of an internship, 21-year-old Iman said she was told to remove her hijab or otherwise I will end up as a cleaning lady. "I wasn't able to continue the internship because of my decision to follow my religion." Similarly, 28-year-old Shazia said she was denied a position as a nursery teacher. "I was told white Germans will not feel comfortable sending their kids to a nursery with someone that is dressed the way I am," unquote. In a study published by the Institute for the Study of Labor in Bonn, 1,500 identical CVs were sent to German firms, except some used the name Miriam Osterk and others Sandra Bohr. In 18.8% of cases, Bohr was invited for an interview, while Osterk was invited in just 13.5% of cases. When the photo of Osterk showed her in a headscarf, she was invited in just 4.2% of cases. Researchers noted that these results suggest that a woman who wears a headscarf would have to send 4.5 times as many applications to receive the same number of callbacks as an applicant with a German-sounding name. Germany and other Western countries hold stark prejudices about how Muslim women are treated within their culture and religion. A common stereotype is that Muslim women from migrant backgrounds are less likely to enter the job market because of cultural differences, such as being housewives and raising children. It is not considered, however, that it is much harder for Muslim women to integrate into the job market because of discriminatory practices, such as those upheld by German neutrality laws. Such discrimination can discourage women from participating in the labor market and even from attaining an education. Some young Muslim women choose careers based not just on interest but also on the potential obstacles they may have to overcome because of their hijab. Mariam told Middle East Eye, "I haven't entered the job market yet, but I have to constantly change my preferences because of discrimination in the workplace." At the same time, 25-year-old Medina said she avoids some jobs together. "I consciously do not apply anywhere where I have direct customer contact to avoid the obstacles of neutrality," she said. A Muslim woman is thus not judged by her qualifications, but by whether she is German enough to work. Zalal, 27, told Middle East Eye that whenever she applies for a job and gets an interview, her qualifications receive maybe 5 minutes of conversation, while her headscarf sparks 15 minutes of discussion. "Most Muslim women in Germany just want to be treated equitably. As Sophie, 29, put it, life in this society is hard, stressful, and psychologically painful. At the same time, I'm grateful for parts of society that react more openly and do not see and treat you like a second-class person just because you are visibly Muslim."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.